This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. And in today's program, we will be looking at the latest nuclear developments, including a contentious congressional hearing today about how four nuclear regulatory commissioners conspired to delay and weaken nuclear reactor safety in the wake of Fukushima. Also today, we'll hear from Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates about the process that is colloquially known as the China Syndrome that is taking place at those doomed reactors at Fukushima. Although in that case, it should be called the Brazil Syndrome, because that's the antipodes of Japan, approximately. All of that and more coming up today. This is 5 o'clock shadow, and I'm Robert Knight in New York. Thursday, the 15th of December, is the National Bill of Rights Day, and there are reasons to be concerned about the viability of that concept, particularly in light of current legislation called the National Defense Authorization Act that was passed on December 1st by Congress and seems to be headed towards enactment. This is the bill that would give the United States military the power to imprison American citizens as well as others indefinitely and without trial or any proof that they committed a crime. Posse comitatus be damned. And the organization, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, just earlier today at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., held a major press conference on that. We'll have more in the coming days about that very issue. And among those speaking were Shahid Buttar, the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Sue Udry of the Defending Dissent Foundation, Professor David Cole from Georgetown, and our live guest today, Bruce Fein, a former Reagan Administration Assistant Attorney General. And Bruce, it's great to have you back on 5 o'clock shadow with the cogency of your legal analyses. And you are saying that the National Defense Authorization Act proves, quote, that a people of sheep invites a government of wolves. Can you describe what this legislation does and why you made that statement about it?
Yes, if I could preface it, is because you've got to understand the legislation in light of the presumptions, philosophical and otherwise, behind our entire Constitution and who we are as a nation. And if we go back to Magna Carta 1215 and move forward to the Declaration of Independence, we find a continuity in the expression that the one purpose we have for forming government is to defend those unalienable rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And since the goal of government, the glory of a republic, is liberty, that the burden is on the government whenever it encroaches on that liberty. Of course, sometimes there are. We don't have the liberty to commit murder or mayhem or things of that sort, but we don't permit one person to just stand up and convict somebody on his say-so alone of a crime. We have due process, so if you make an accusation of such antisocial conduct, you have to prove it. There's an opportunity to respond. So liberty is the rule, and what this particular statute does is it turns it on its head. Incarceration and detention and encroachment becomes the rule, and liberty becomes the exception, because expressly and tacitly it recognizes power in government to detain you or me or anyone in your audience on the say-so of the president alone, just saying you are substantially assisting Al-Qaeda or Taliban or associated forces in attacking us or our enemy. They don't have to identify exactly what the substantial assistance is. They don't have to identify who is Al-Qaeda, who is Taliban, who are associated forces. And they don't even have to disclose the factual basis for that accusation. Once they make it, then they can detain you for your life without trial, without charging you of a crime, which is a power that the Founding Fathers described as the very definition of tyranny. That's the gist of it, I think, that the audience can understand. There's nothing that prevents any military man tomorrow from showing up on your sidewalk with an AK-47, a Ukase, something like that, and says, oh, we think that you are somehow associated with assisting international terrorist forces, not necessarily even hostile to the United States, but hostile to one of our allies. Could be Pakistan, could be the Philippines or something. Ergo, off you go to Guantanamo. You're in the dungeon for life. No accusation you've ever actually committed a crime. And I say that's something when I grew up I associated with the Soviet Union, not the United States.
Bruce, the concept of posse comitatus, it's a bold concept that protects American citizens from the arbitrary behavior of military domestic law enforcement. But it's my fear and understanding that it's more like a fond memory than the law of the land. Can you speak to the issue of posse comitatus and the exclusion that has been traditional, at least until now, of leaving policing to police and not to soldiers?
Yes. Well, it probably is a strange phraseology to many in your audience, so let me give a little bit of a background. Right after the Civil War, the United States governed the southern seceded states, one known as the Confederate States, in military regions, and the military became law enforcement until these states were readmitted to the Union. And as a revulsion against that military usurpation, if you will, of civilian authority, Congress, after Reconstruction, passed a law. The Posse Comitatus Law says, unless Congress explicitly states otherwise, there is no authority in the military to exercise law enforcement responsibilities. And I say that's important both for civilians as well as the military. The military is trained to do one thing, kill the enemy and shoot, because that's why we have the military, to fight wars. And you can imagine when you're trained to that sense of a lethal force, you're not likely to ask questions when you come upon someone who seems to be an adversary. You treat them not as a civilian and a co-citizen, but as the enemy. For that time, for perhaps 100 years, posse comitatus virtually was never overruled by Congress. They never went beyond the baseline statute saying, no, the ordinary rule is if military has no involvement at all in civilian law enforcement. We had a little break in the war against international drug trafficking, where the military now tries to interdict some of these shipments, which I think is quite foolish. But in any event, this is a wholesale encroachment on posse comitatus by authorizing the military. Any time that anyone says, aha, someone is substantially assisting an organization that's affiliated with al-Qaeda or Taliban, then they become the target for military detention without trial, without accusation. Okay, and it's quite a dangerous usurpation of civilian authority by the military. Basically, it means that the military, we now don't have civilian supremacy. We've got military supremacy anytime a president wants to employ it. Now, many in the audience say, well, Mr. Obama doesn't have a Napoleonic personality. He's not looking for mausoleums and Muslim obelisks, so he's not going to abuse the power. That may well be true, but the principle now is lying around like a loaded weapon, ready for any Caligula in office, anyone who's got more of a megalomania to them, and I think we see some of them out running for president already, to abuse it far beyond what any prudence would suggest.
Well, let the record show that President Barack Obama has already been conducting extrajudicial deprivations of life of American citizens. The legislation of this defense authorization bill, which we also note for the record, Senator Carl Levin, one of the co-sponsors of it, recently stated in the halls of Congress that the provision for military detention indefinitely of American citizens had been out of the bill, but was put back in at the specific insistence of President Barack Obama and his administration. How close is this law to becoming, this bill to becoming the law of the land?
Maybe 24 hours away. There were small differences in the House and Senate bills. They've been reconciled in the conference committee. I would expect the House will vote on the bill sometime this evening and get to the Senate Thursday or Friday. I would hope that someone like Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky would put a hold on it so at least the American people know that they're driving over a cliff here and making the United States into a police state that we have customarily for the last 200 years associated with those countries that we viewed as non-democratic.
So we're 24 hours possibly away from becoming a military police state at the insistence of President Barack Obama.
That is correct. And Barack Obama has even beyond Bush and Cheney in claiming and asserting and exercising arbitrary, tyrannical executive power, one that you mentioned, assassinating one of our citizens, Mr. Awlaki, in Yemen without any accusation. He wasn't even under indictment. He hadn't been charged with any crime whatsoever. There was no attempt to capture him, just used a predator drone to kill him. And then a few days later, his 16-year-old son was equally vaporized by a predator drone. So we do have a president who, in all intents and purposes, is far more omnipotent than King George III that we found sufficiently tyrannical to overthrow 220-some years ago.
We're speaking with former Deputy Attorney General of the United States, Bruce Fine. The remedy to this, if there is indeed a remedy in these days of paranoia and madness that stampede people into the widespread loss of all rights and rationality, when people like yourselves and others of us who believe in the rights and prerogatives of citizenship challenge this, we've got a situation with a power-mad executive branch and president. We've got a compliant legislature that seems legislative branch that seems unconscious of the principles of the U.S. Constitution. And that gives me pause, because if this were to ever be challenged in the Supreme Court, is it not the court's tradition to not go against two out of three, to not challenge something that is compliant between the executive and legislative branches? Are we also screwed at the Supreme Court level?
I think that there is room for hope. If we look at the cluster of cases that have been decided by the U.S. Supreme Court post 9/11, the administration has won a handful, but liberty has won a handful, including, most importantly, an invalidation of a provision of the Military Commissions Act that suspended habeas corpus for those who were detained at Guantanamo Bay, a case called Boumediene versus Bush. So that there is, and there was another case striking down the use of military commissions in lieu of civilian courts for the trial of certain offenses. I'm certainly not willing to bet my estate. Maybe if I was Mitt Romney, I would, because I wouldn't need my $10,000 in my pocket like he doesn't, that the Supreme Court would invalidate this provision. I think it will be very closely contested. But there have been occasions when the court has displayed moral courage, but there have been equally occasions when displayed moral cowardice. The most glaring example during World War II, when the court flinched at the concentration camps for Japanese American citizens based solely on ancestry, when there had equally been no showing that they had committed any crime of danger, sabotage, or otherwise. So it's not that the court is guaranteed to be a beacon of strength here, but it might. And especially odd about this statute is the fact that here it comes after the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And we know a lot more about how delusional it is to think that al-Qaeda threatens the sovereignty of the United States. Now we have counterterrorism experts say the maximum number of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is maybe 50 to 100. So we know that we're not threatened by our sovereign government and Republican, to the extent it remains Republican, system of checks and balances by these, what I would call, criminal terrorist thugs abroad. And yet the Congress, 10 years after the fact, decides it needs to augment in encroaching on liberty, in endowing the president with these tyrannical powers, an executive, when it didn't need to do so, right at the time where we're all fearful that maybe there was greater penetration with al-Qaeda cells in the United States, namely just a few moments after 9/11. So it seems odd that now, when we understand how diminished the risk is of al-Qaeda even attacking us criminally, we come forth with even a larger nuclear bomb, if you will, destroying our own Republican values to address the threat that's almost invisible to Americans. I don't think that there's a single member of your audience who's ever gone to sleep worried and shaken to believe that they'd wake up, you know, and they'd be threatened by an al-Qaeda attack when they woke up morning. And yet here we have in the name of a so-called safety, a destruction of who we are as a nation.
Bruce, I wake up frightened every day Congress is in session. Because the Senate voted 93-7, if I recall correctly, to pass this legislation, which means that there is a bipartisan conspiracy. Democrat, Republican appears to be a distinction without any difference. What has happened to the political system and with debates of great passion and principle and institutional memory? Why bother voting for either one of them if this is what they're going to do to the Constitution?
Well, what I could suggest your audience should read in my recent book called American Empire Before the Fall. And what I describe is a psychology of empire, which seeks as a nation to achieve a risk-free existence. That's what all empires try to do, this illusion that you can live both free and risk-free. You can't have that. But this idea that seeps in to the public thinking, more instinct than by any rational deliberation, that, oh, we shouldn't have to accept any risk whatsoever, even a mosquito bite. So even one person who's angry and maybe demented and wants to suggest he wants to attack the United States becomes the equivalent of the Japanese Zero airplanes and the Luftwaffe and the Soviet Red Army, and therefore we magnify the danger a millionfold and say, oh, we can't possibly accept that tiny risk. We have to go to war, and at wartime we can't accept liberties, and therefore we have to have the military take over law enforcement and suspend transparency for secrecy and everything. And that's where our leadership truly is betraying the American people and the American Republic. Not a single member, not a single president, executive says, wait a minute, we have to accept some risk or we'll destroy all freedom. The only way you can reduce the risk of another 9/11 to zero, if you want a zero risk, then you got to incarcerate everybody, because no one can give a 100% guarantee they will never turn to mischief or evil, which destroys the whole purpose of having a nation. But there's been no leadership suggesting the American people we have to put the danger in proper, measured context. And if we think of how much we're spending on the so-called threat of international terrorism, it's about $1.2 trillion annually. So I've calculated what we style our national security budget. It's $4,000 or $5,000 per capita. And if I went around to all your audience and said, hey, listen, I'll sell you an insurance policy, $4,000, and I'll guarantee that you're not going to be harmed by, I'll pay you $100,000 if Al-Qaeda kills you or kidnaps you over the next year. I mean, no one would buy the policy. They'd say, that's crazy. I'm not going to pay $4,000 for that. You know, that's a Bernie Madoff scam. But that's what we are doing through the tax system and by the inflated fear that's created by these hysterical speeches and whatever by our politicians. Our leaders are failing us. And that's why I chastise more than any other element of our whole political dispensation now. No leaders, they turn out to be just human weather vanes, and the tiniest risk then is said, no, where the sky is falling down, you know, we'll have thousands, tens of thousands of bodies on the sidewalk unless we give the president or the military all of these unlimited powers. And it's up to us as a people, as citizens, say, no, we will not elect members to the House or to the presidency who will accept and exploit fear-mongering. We need to accept some risk, not stupid risk, but we have to accept some. That's the price of liberty.
Well, 93 senators who voted for it would be a good start. We're speaking with Bruce Fein, the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy. He is the former Deputy Attorney General under President Ronald Reagan. And final question, Bruce, I know you have appointments and commitments on this day, and we thank your clarion call on this burning issue today. Final word for you in terms of what people who are just astonished by this Obama initiative might do on Thursday, the 15th of December, Bill of Rights Day. You have the final word, sir.
Well, there are going to be some demonstrations, maybe not as large as Occupy Wall Street, but it's truly stunning that there has been so little outcry, which explains what I said at the outset, if you have a people of sheep, you get a government of wolves. Mm. You know, it's truly a travesty that on the Bill of Rights Day, we are now going to be crowning, we're going to be writing an epitaph for the Bill of Rights. And we need to remember that history is biography. What we do as citizens in protest is the direction the country is going to take. And I just encourage everyone in their own way to voice the principle that this is simply not acceptable to this group of people. And you never know when small numbers can multiply. We are sort of stunned probably this week, see how many decided to defy Vladimir Putin, who had then swindled the Russian people out of a fair election. And no one thought that he was vulnerable whatsoever, but there are a few courageous people stood up, and it seems to have taken some traction. And that's what's got to happen in the United States. Remember, even if this bill passes and it's signed, it can always be repealed. You know, history is not static. It's always dynamic, and we want to make the dynamism work in our favor.
Well, the very best to you, Bruce, and thank you for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. Bruce Fine, the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy, former Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we remind you once again that Senator Carl Levin, in recent congressional testimony, stated explicitly that it was at the behest of President Barack Obama that there be included in this defense authorization bill military indefinite detention without trial or accusation or proof.
And I'm wondering whether the senator is familiar with the fact that the language which precluded the application of Section 1031 to American citizens was in the bill that we originally approved in the Armed Services Committee, and the administration asked us to remove the language which says that U.S. citizens and lawful residents would not be subject to this section. Is the senator familiar with the fact that it was the administration that asked us to remove the very language which we had in the bill which passed the committee, and that we removed it at the request of the administration that would have said that this determination would not apply to U.S. citizens and lawful residents? I'm just wondering, is the senator familiar with the fact that it was the administration which asked us to remove the very language, the absence of which is now objected to by the senator from Illinois?
I'm familiar now because the senator from Michigan has shared that fact with me.
This was Obama's provision in this legislation. And, well, what more can we say than this? song for Barack, performed by Stevie Wonder with backing by the Jackson 5. The song, You Haven't Done Nothing, on this eve of Bill of Rights Day and the imminence of military police state in the United States and arbitrary military detentions and executive assassinations of American citizens. What hath Obama wrought? This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we turn now to the nuclear portion of today's program, in which there was a congressional hearing in the House of Representatives today on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And in that hearing, there was what could be kindly described as a lynch mob against the chief member of the commissioners of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, attempting to say that he was abrasive and not simpatico with the more industry-identified members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The hearing was chaired by Representative Edward Markey of Massachusetts, and he is the author of a study on what really happened inside the NRC, and the study is called Regulatory Meltdown: How Four Nuclear Regulatory Commissioners Conspired to Delay and Weaken Nuclear Reactor Safety in the Wake of Fukushima. Just a short time ago, during those hearings, there was this exchange where one member of the House panel explicitly wondered about why the more conventional members were challenging Chairman Yasko about sharing with the government and the public a deeper truth about the depth of the disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power complex, which is suffering from at least four and possibly more nuclear malfunctions in that farm on the coast of a half dozen nuclear power plants. This is what happened earlier today in those congressional hearings.
Chairman Jasko, do you see a philosophical difference between yourself and your fellow commissioners with respect to the mission of NRC and how to go about it?
Well, we do have different approaches to what we believe is safe and how we define safety. And I think that's clear in the different votes that we cast and the positions that we take as commissioners.
Well, specifically hone in on Fukushima. You answered a question about Fukushima just a little while ago to one of my colleagues, and you confirmed that in fact there was an attempt by your four fellow commissioners to bury some of the findings of that study and or to aggressively look at lessons learned from the single worst nuclear disaster in world history.
We did have a disagreement.
You did?
On the release of...
You did? Is that what you said?
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
About the release of the report and whether or not it should be reviewed by the commission prior to ever being released publicly.
What was the nature of that dispute?
Well, it was simply that I believe the report, once it was completed, should be made publicly available and so that the public could see what the views of...
Your commissioners disagreed with that?
There were some who did disagree and wanted the report to be reviewed and perhaps acted on by the commission and changed before it was released publicly.
And that was NRC Chair Jasko responding to congressional questions today about the attempted suppression by mainstream members and industry-friendly members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission trying to suppress an early response report done by field team members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, revealing that the Fukushima disaster was the single worst nuclear malfunction in world history, and trying to suppress, delay, sanitize that report. The executive summary of Representative Markey's prolegomena for these hearings is as follows, and I think it bears hearing to see just how nuclear fuel may not be able to be contained, but there have been attempts to contain the information about their hazard. From the executive summary of the study by Markey called Regulatory Meltdown, It reads as follows. In the wake of the meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, member Edward J. Markey of Massachusetts issued a report, numerous letters, and introduced legislation aimed at highlighting personal safety vulnerabilities and accelerating the implementation of needed safety enhancements. Markey was particularly concerned that the commission was moving too slowly to adopt these new measures. In late October 2011, Markey sent a letter to the NRC requesting copies of all documents, including voting records, reports, emails, correspondence, memoranda, phone or meeting minutes, or other materials related to the events at Fukushima, of the NRC's response thereto prepared or obtained by any commissioner or member of the commissioner's staff. While most commissioners marked every single document, including articles that appeared in public media, to be not for public release, this narrative is an effort to provide a summary of the thousands of pages of materials that were responsive to that request. And the review of the materials indicates that, one, four NRC commissioners attempted to delay and otherwise impede the creation of the NRC near-term task force on Fukushima. Number two, four commissioners conspired with each other and with senior NRC staff to delay the release of and alter the NRC near-term task force report on Fukushima. Number three, the other NRC commissioners attempted to slow down or otherwise impede the adoption of the safety recommendations made by the NRC near-term task force on Fukushima. Number four, NRC Chair Greg Yasko kept the other four commissioners fully informed regarding the Japanese emergency, despite claims to the contrary made by those commissioners. Number five, a review of emails and other documents indicates high levels of suspicion and hostility directed at the chair. And number six, the consideration of the Fukushima safety upgrades is not the only safety-related issue that the other NRC commissioners have opposed. That from the study, Regulatory Meltdown, by Representative Edward Markey. We have more on the nuclear front with our correspondent and interlocutor, Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates, explaining what it really means that there is a meltdown and China syndrome, although we hear on 5 o'clock shadow call it a Brazil syndrome because that's the antipodes of Japan approximately. Here is Arne Gunderson about the real depth of the meltdown at Fukushima.
Hi, I'm Arne Gunderson from Fairwinds. Last week, Tokyo Electric announced that the core inside the nuclear reactor had definitely melted through and had also melted partly through the containment at Fukushima. I wanted to talk about that today, because I think there's been a lot of exaggerations and misunderstandings on the internet about what's actually going on. So the question I'd like to talk about today is, can Fukushima become what's called the China syndrome? And what exactly does the China syndrome really mean?
I don't know. They might have come close to exposing the core.
If that's true, then we came very close to the China syndrome.
The what?
If the core is exposed, for whatever reason, the fuel heats beyond core heat tolerance in a matter of minutes. Nothing can stop it. And it melts right down through the bottom of the plant, theoretically, to China. But of course, as soon as it hits groundwater, it blasts into the atmosphere and sends out clouds of radioactivity. The number of people killed would depend on which way the wind is blowing. Render an area the size of Pennsylvania permanently uninhabitable, not to mention the cancer that would show up later.
The term is really old. It dates back at least until the 60s. And what it means is that the nuclear core melts. And of course, it's an American term. So it melted from America toward China through the center of the Earth. That's what the term means. It's an over-exaggeration to begin with. But it does mean that the nuclear core leaves the nuclear reactor, leaves the containment, and gets into the Earth. That's what a China syndrome really means. Now, I'll be using some rather crude demonstration items today. I realize a lot of engineers watch this, and just bear with me here. I think these are analogies, and they're always a little risky, but I do think they explain what's happening inside Fukushima. The first phase of the accident was when the nuclear reactor core lost its cooling. Now, you'll remember uranium atoms split. 95% of the power comes from uranium atoms splitting. But these pieces that are left over are called fission products, and they retain a lot of heat. When you shut a nuclear reactor down, a process that takes about 2 seconds, 95% of the heat stops immediately, but 5% of the heat can't be stopped. Now, that, as long as there's extra water flowing, is all you need to keep a nuclear reactor cool. You remember back in April, I did a video where I talked about a nuclear reactor fuel pellet. It was about as big as my pinky, and the fuel rod is about the diameter of my pinky, but 12 feet long. In a lot of ways, it's like spaghetti. It's just as flexible as spaghetti, but of course it's 12 feet long. And there are thousands of these nuclear fuel rods inside a nuclear reactor. A nuclear reactor isn't anything but a glorified pressure cooker. A pressure cooker cooks at 15 pounds, a nuclear reactor cooks at 1,000 pounds. But essentially they're the same thing. They're designed to hold really hot water and not to leak. Well, the nuclear fuel is placed into the nuclear reactor, and as long as the water's in there, everything's fine. But like when you overcook spaghetti, what happens? It can form a blob on the bottom of your pressure cooker. That's what happened at Fukushima. The decay products created enough heat to boil off all the water, and the nuclear fuel collapsed. The pasta broke and is now a blob at the bottom of the nuclear reactor. That happened in about 6 to 8 hours on Fukushima 1, and perhaps as long as 10 hours on Fukushima 2 and 3. So the first phase of this accident is called a meltdown. That's when the pasta collapses and lays in the bottom of the pressure cooker. That's when the nuclear fuel melts and lays in the bottom of the nuclear reactor. Phase 1 is a meltdown. The second step in the process is something called a melt through. Now, we're at a point where we've got a blob of nuclear fuel at the bottom of the nuclear reactor vessel. And TEPCO is saying that the nuclear reactor vessel is about 8 inches thick, about 30 centimeters thick, and that's enough to hold the nuclear fuel for quite a long time. I don't think that part of TEPCO's analysis is right. I've talked about it before, but on a boiling water reactor, there's over 60 holes in the bottom of the reactor for the control rods to go in and out. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has already identified that it's likely that the nuclear fuel didn't have to melt through the 8 inches of steel, but instead could do an end run around that and shoot out the holes at the bottom of the reactor. So almost like soft ice cream falling out of a dispenser, it's like hot nuclear fuel pouring out of these holes on the bottom of the reactor. That phase is called a melt through. Probably within a day of the beginning of the Fukushima accident, we were in the phase where nuclear fuel was melting through the nuclear pressure vessel. Now remember, the nuclear reaction has stopped. None of this is heat from the chain reaction, and all of it is coming from the nuclear daughter products. After about a day, instead of about 5% of the heat coming from the nuclear daughter products, we're down to less than 1% of the nuclear heat. So now we've got a blob that's left the pressure cooker and is now lying flat on the floor underneath the nuclear reactor. There's some assumptions here. If there was a crater on the bottom of the nuclear reactor, the blob would have fallen into that crater and the heat would have been concentrated. That would have allowed this nuclear blob to work its way down into the nuclear containment faster. And again, that's an assumption. No one really knows what's going on underneath that nuclear reactor. No one can get within 100 feet of the bottom of that nuclear reactor. And it'll be 20 or 30 years before we really find out what that area looks like. But the assumption is that the nuclear fuel lying on the floor has begun to eat away at the containment. So phase two is when it ate through the containment. Phase three is the beginning of what would ultimately become a China syndrome. At the bottom of the nuclear containment is about 3 feet of concrete and about 2 inches of steel. We're quite certain that the nuclear fuel has left the reactor and is lying on the bottom of the containment. And the question is how deep into the concrete it's worked its way and has it broken through the steel? I don't think it's broken through the steel, and I think it's perhaps as much as a foot or two into the 3 feet of concrete. But that does not make a China syndrome. The reason it's not working its way down any further is because the radioactive daughter products are no longer generating anywhere near as much heat as they did on the very first day of the accident. In fact, they're probably generating less than 1 million watts of power right now. Now, that's a lot of heat. 1 million watts is 10,000 100-watt light bulbs. And you can imagine that that would generate a lot of heat. But compared to what was available on the first day and the second day and the first week, the amount of decay heat is very small. In addition, right above all this nuclear melted fuel is an awful lot of water. The water's at less than 100 degrees centigrade. It's not boiling. And what that means is that there's an enormous ability for that water to suck the heat out of the nuclear core as it lies on the bottom of the containment. And I don't believe that the nuclear core can melt down through the containment and into the water table. There's been all sorts of postulations about violent explosions from this. And again, I don't think that can happen because the amount of heat available. Now we're almost 9 months after the accident, is not great enough to create what's called a steam explosion. So the good news is, I don't think a China syndrome can happen. I don't think this core can keep melting into the bottom of the earth. And I don't think there'll be a steam explosion either. That's the good news. Here's the bad news. That nuclear core is in direct contact with tons of water. And that containment, while not leaking down, is leaking out the sides. That contaminated water is going into every other building on site. And there's literally thousands and thousands of tons of water in other buildings. That water contains radioactive cesium, radioactive strontium, and it also contains nuclear fuel. There'll be uranium in that water and plutonium in that water as well. We know for sure that that water is leaking into the groundwater and into the Pacific Ocean. So while it's important to know that we're not going to release the nuclear core directly into the center of the Earth, the problem isn't over. And as a matter of fact, the problem will last for tens, perhaps even as long as 30 years, because this contaminated water is in the basements of all the buildings on site. And not only does it contain cesium, that hangs around for 300 years, strontium hangs around for 300 years, but it also contains plutonium and uranium, and they have half-lives of tens of thousands of years. So the problem is, what do we do with all that water that's contaminated? It's already leaking into the groundwater. It's already leaking into the ocean. TEPCO is frantically catching it and putting it into tanks. But just today, TEPCO announced that they're running out of tank space on site, and eventually they're going to have to release those tanks into the Pacific Ocean. Now, they'll try to clean up some of the isotopes like cesium, but they have been unable to capture all the strontium. Strontium's a bone seeker that causes leukemia. So we're not out of the woods. We're far from out of the woods. It'll be 30 years before we capture all that nuclear fuel that's underneath that reactor vessel. And until then, it'll be surrounded with water that's leaking into the groundwater. I'll keep you informed as the situation develops. Thank you.
Arne Gundersen, nuclear engineer. and specialist with Fairwinds Associates. The website is Fairwinds, FAIREWINDS.com. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. Thanks to former Deputy Attorney General of the United States, Bruce Fein, for joining us live today on this eve of Bill of Rights Day and the eve of destruction of constitutional protections with the Obama administration's military indefinite detention legislation that was voted in favor of by 93 out of 100 United States senators. Thanks to Michael G. Haskins for engineering today. Giacomo Piroso is our associate producer. And we welcome your comments, tips, leaks, suggestions, and questions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. For 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.